And you are listening to KBOO Portland.
Tuesday nights on KBOO, it's Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush.
With DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid.
10 p.m. to midnight.
2 hours of global bass featuring Bhangra, Bollywood,
and the urban sounds of the global diaspora. You done know.
It's about 6 o'clock. Coming up next, we have QTPOC here on KBOO Radio. This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, the transportation choice of Portlanders since 1946, with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab has a mobile app that allows you to book a cab with your phone, available at the App Store, Google Play, and at radiocab.net. Or if you prefer, you can talk to a real person at 503-227-1212. This program has also been made possible with a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. Smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Catch my fly and my cocky fresh. My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas. Make a Texas, make a Texas, make a, make a, make a, make a, make, 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 you mix that Negro with that Creole, 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 Creole.
Greetings and welcome to Cutie Pock Talk. I'm Darian Jones here with Phoenix.
This is Phoenix Singer.
And our special guest today, Angelita Murillo from X-Ray FM.
Hello.
Hi, Angelita. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you here on the show today. So essentially today we kind of wanted to do a follow-up episode in conjunction with the last one on kind of the results of our presidential election here and kind of the response that we've received from Portland and the community activism that's kind of gone around that. And so before we kind of dive too deep in that, I just kind of want to, you know, bring up the fact that, you know, yesterday was the official vote for the Electoral College to select the next president of the United States. And as predicted, it was Donald Trump. And following that, there was another event that was held downtown led by Portland's Resistance, which was another protest that started yesterday around 5:30. And, you know, it seemed to me that the same kind of community response that initially started from Portland's Resistance was there. Is that what you all saw as well, too? And kind of what was your initial feelings and response to, I mean, just the election? Angelita, I know we haven't had your voice here on the show, and just to kind of get your perspective on maybe how you're, you've been impacted by it.
Yeah. Well, I think what's a little bit odd is on election night, most people around me were pretty frantic and shocked and just generally appalled. No one really believed that this is what would happen. And I had been doing the stats for the election, and most of the polls showed that Hillary would win. So mm-hmm. It was surprising to me in that way. But I felt oddly calm because I very much expected this to happen. To me, it was just a moment of calm where I understood what was happening and that this would be a time of really big change for all of us. And I think it hasn't affected me in many ways because although I am a Latina immigrant, I am white passing and I already have my citizenship. And so I don't have the same fears that some of my friends and loved ones do. But I think it definitely just shifted the whole mood of the city and of school. I just noticed that any petty arguments kind of dissipated. It became this dawning realization that big things were happening now and that we didn't have time to not be united anymore.
Right. And like Phoenix, is that the same thing that you've kind of witnessed around community in response to? Or because I know there have been a few different groups organizing that I've seen who maybe aren't organizing in community in that same sense, even though we're all directly impacted.
Oh, there definitely was a lot of, I think, maybe even kind of naive shock and surprise at the Electoral College made the decisions that they did. To me, it didn't seem like trying to convince the Electoral College to vote against Trump was really going to mean anything.
Right.
Clearly, it didn't. Mm-hmm. And what we actually saw with a lot of Democrats defected even from Clinton.
That's surprising.
Towards, Bernie Sanders, Colin Powell, surprisingly, for some weird reason. Though it definitely seemed to me like this was not the best investment of our time and energy and resources. But a lot of folks put a lot of like time and hope into the idea that this group of people, which historically had never done what they're asking them to do, would do that.
Right, which I think has kind of been the reason for the roar in the country. I think there's another protest that's scheduled to happen sometime around the inauguration, and I'm kind of
series of them.
And I'm kind of curious to see kind of like what the impact is. Like, what's the end goal here for all of our communities? Because I've seen people out on the microphones and getting attacked, and it's just really hard to kind of continue watching it. So, you know, I'm kind of wondering what happens to these peaceful protests as more and more people get hurt, and kind of like how people can start working together in community to kind of shape that and what the future is going to look like. And I know you were talking about earlier this kind of macro lens about how this entire system is working together, but it doesn't seem like that's going to be the right way in the future for us.
I definitely think that when it comes to a lot of these protests, we are seeing like an escalation of violence against them, both in and outside of like these formal organizing spaces. And I do think that folks are going to have to honestly confront the fact that people are going to get hurt, and we need to better defend ourselves and protect each other, have more medics on guard, things like that. But it doesn't seem like many of the organizers are very interested in even the idea of a principled self-defense. Not necessarily an offense, but a defense.
Yeah.
So what kind of things can we do in community to help defend ourselves? Because I know I've seen a few different groups going on. There's a QDPOC group I believe you and Olivia invited me to for kind of martial arts and preparing ourselves for the future, of like really being ready for the fight that's inevitable that we're kind of seeing now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm really wondering, just for me, like a way... other ways to engage with the movement, just because, you know, it's definitely hard for some people to make it down to those protests, and it's hard for people to show up at meetings. And
I was just gonna say, I think that's a kind of a common. There are a few concerns that I've heard from a lot of people, and one, it's that they have a principled stance against any form of offense or what they would deem as violence, so they want to not do that during protests. And then there's also people who are concerned about like losing their jobs or maybe getting in trouble in some way like that, or maybe they have children and they can't leave them at home alone for the protests. For the people who are worried about losing status or losing their jobs or something, all I have to say is that people of color haven't been hired forever, and you're worried about losing your job because it's a security that you've always had, but Trump's presidency directly affects everyone else's security, people of color, minorities, vulnerable groups. And so I know what I'm saying is really harsh, and it comes off harsh that I'm saying you should be willing to risk these luxuries that you've had, but that's the truth, because we're going to bring about a lot of change, and that's going to challenge power. And whenever you challenge power, there's going to be repercussions. As for people who have children or can't organize in that way, what I have suggested is maybe creating like a daycare in your neighborhood for people who want to protest, so that they can bring their kids there, somewhere where they will be safe and taken care of while parents go protest, something like that. And for people who have a principled stance against violence and want peaceful protest, I just hope that they remember what peaceful protest actually looks like, because it is going to be years of facing violence against the police, and it's going to be brutal, because if you're not violent, that's fine. But the state has no problem being violent against us. The state has no conscience where they can't do that, because at the end of the day, we've seen people get murdered on camera. We saw that with Eric Garner, and it doesn't change anything. It doesn't move them. And so if you are going to do peaceful protests, you have to be ready for brutality. You have to be ready to understand that there is risk involved, and it is really heroic and it is really beautiful, but it's gonna hurt.
So you said something interesting eloquently, the word risk, and understanding that risk is involved in kind of what your risk is as a person. And it speaks to kind of this notion of people wanting to get active and get engaged and do things, but not understanding the risk. And, you know, it's a really hot topic in my mind right now, because I know you talked to earlier, we spoke before the show about bodies and wanting them there. Yeah. And I know as a person of color, I too was seeking kind of like maybe refuge in some of the talks that have been going on across the city. And there was a larger one a few weeks ago that I don't want to name any of the organizer of the group, but, you know, 150 plus people were at the last one, and I attended this group as well to, you know, try to get out of the rut of kind of sadness and perhaps like depression I'd been in since the vote had been cast. And ultimately, it turned into, you know, a group of 100 plus people breaking off into groups of 10. And there wasn't enough structure within those groups. So the main catalyst for getting people engaged, I haven't seen that same level of structure, and you know, there's no plan set for what we kind of want to see as a goal. And you know, one idea is to start raising monies for organizations that we want to support, and there's a great group that does that called Social Justice Fund Northwest, and they support a lot of advocacy groups of nonprofits doing great work. And so, you know, a lot of new groups I think have been starting up with the heat of everything and the anger and the raw emotion, but I haven't seen the same kind of plan, especially a plan that includes people of color at the forefront, and in a sense of like protecting them, not like putting them to be like, hey, you need to like champion this idea.
Definitely.
And so, you know, it's just turned into a conversation, which I'll save for a later segment, on, you know, why it's so important to talk to your neighbors, but not the people of color talk to their neighbors, but for the white allies to actually show up and talk to their neighbors, and what that actually means.
I mean, so I think a lot of what I'm hearing from you is that it started off, there was a big emotional outburst and people were willing to get out on the streets. And then it's almost like, or at least from what I've observed, the white allies kind of calmed down because it doesn't really affect them for a while. And so, it's just kind of slowly started sinking into apathy. People aren't posting as much. People aren't thinking as much because it's winter break now and we don't have to think about these things anymore. You know, it's Christmas. But there was a lot of emotional support during the protests. People, my white allies kept saying like, I'm too emotionally afflicted to go, but if you need to talk, you can come back and talk to me.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I am a Latina immigrant and I'm going to these protests. And, if you think that it hasn't emotionally affected me and that I am not depressed and angry and all of these things, I'm still getting out there and marching. And so I think I've started getting a little harsh because I'm getting impatient, where I'm like, you need to start putting yourself out there and doing something. And I know it's really early. I think it's really early right now for a lot of organizations, and people aren't sure exactly what they want out of this yet. And so a lot of people get discouraged because they say, well, what are we really fighting for? What's the point? Why am I marching? Why am I putting myself on the line? But I think the fact that we have questions about what we want is really important, and that just means that we are going to polish that and perfect that and really start asking for what we want, because the iron is hot right now. This is the moment to strike. And so I think that the fact that we have questions that are being asked is not a reason to be discouraged. It's a reason to get out there, to start listening to different groups, to figure out where you belong, and to put yourself out there, because we need people right now. We need people to think and to put their bodies on the line.
Yeah, and that's much more eloquent than I could have kind of vocalized for the realities that we're kind of facing, where it's, you know, people of color aren't just showing up because this impacts people of color. You know, people of color are showing up because this impacts everyone, and we are at the forefront. Like, if we don't show up, we can't survive. And kind of asking allies to do that in a way that not necessarily benefits us, but empowers us in a way where we're still our whole selves. Because some of the events that I've attended, their people of color end up teaching everyone else. When, you know, I think it's really hard to be in this society at this time with access to knowledge and the internet and what we have, and to still be someone who still doesn't understand why Black Lives Matter.
Right.
So with that note, I think we're going to head off to our first commercial radio musical break here in three.
They lost inside. It's like they flying. she said we high. Her voice a starlight from heaven sent in beams. When she said one day you'll know exactly what it means.
And we're back to Cutie Pock Talk. I'm Darian Jones.
Phoenix Singer.
Angelita Maru.
Awesome. And where we left off was kind of a conversation about the need for representation from allies in, you know, showing up and what that actually looks like and what that means. Initially, there was a story I wanted to share for the end, but I guess I'll kind of continue in the last portion of the event where people of color were teaching our white allies. And, you know, I'm too am obviously a person of color, but I have never experienced the this exhaustion that a lot of my fellow organizers and community have talked about. And it's a specific type of exhaustion that comes from the need to kind of train and explain and document and relive your racism that you experience in your life to your white allies. And it kind of, you know, it's an interesting conversation to have, but it was about helping people understand how, as a white person, it is your job to talk to other white people. And as a person of color, it's not my job. And that's straight, pretty forward. And the best kind of analogy I could have provided at the event was at this time was that, you know, I could totally understand how John, who might live in Southern Oregon, who is a really great guy and, you know, doesn't think that he's racist and, you know, has never overtly done anything, you know, racist to someone, but how John now, when he goes to the market, might get some shifty eyes from people. John might not feel so welcome in the same community centers because society recently has been talking about the untold narrative of white men and how he might feel that this narrative of oppression and misogyny and patriarchy is something that people see when they look at him, and how in a moment of fear for his security and his life and the privilege that he has, could have voted for Donald Trump, and how, you know, people make decisions, but not all people are bad, right? People make decisions. And so as a person of color, it's really hard for me to ever reach through to John because I'm a person of color. John doesn't want to talk to me already because there's this barrier that's put up. And how, as a white person, it's sort of your job to talk to John if you care about my life or if you care about black and brown lives or lives that wish to exist in a world where Donald Trump will be president.
Or if you care about John.
Or right? If you care about John.
Because I think that the very act of teaching someone is an act of grace, right? You're going through the effort of, you're putting faith in that person that they want to change. And I think that a lot of what I've seen with regards to people like your hypothetical John is that a lot of people didn't believe what Trump was saying. They thought that mm-hmm. he was being just exaggerating for the sake of politics. And I think that that's really dangerous because I mean, I think there have been tons of comparisons made on the internet to a bunch of fascist leaders that Trump compares to, who also made very shocking statements when they were first rising to power. And no one believed them. They kind of mocked it. They thought it was ridiculous. They thought that this man was something to be made fun of, and then didn't realize that, no, he meant every word of what he said and he would act on it. So it's almost like there's a suspension of disbelief on both sides. Trump supporters and Democrats who didn't support Trump, where people think that we are not living in the era that we're living in. It's like right. They think they don't understand how historic this moment is and what their place in that is.
So what do you mean by historic? Like, maybe people just don't understand what this moment means. Would you be able to kind of express that or elaborate a little deeper?
I mean, I think this is just a huge moment. Like, we're seeing a rise in fascism in the United States and also globally.
Yeah.
And this has become totally normalized, and people, I think, who have romanticized ideas, I don't know, I remember in high school, my classmates would say, oh, if we lived in the civil rights movement, we would all be out there doing that. You know, we would all be out there fighting the good fight. And now that the good fight is here and right in their face, I don't see a lot of them doing that.
Yeah.
And it's almost like there's a lot of romanticization in media. Is that a word, romanticization?
Yeah, it was.
I know it's a weird one.
Well, there's a lot of that happening in media where we see like Harry Potter and Star Wars, and we see all these young heroines and heroes going and like fighting their evil oppressors. But then when it comes down to doing it in real life, nobody wants to do that. Everyone wants to act like that's not what's happening right now.
That's pretty real.
Yeah, definitely. I just wanted to quickly say that I mean, MLK critiqued this, I guess you could say this trend during the time he was alive, when in his letter from Birmingham jail, he talked about the white moderate who cares more about order than justice. That's definitely a lot of people today who think that they would have followed MLK when they themselves care more about order than justice.
What is it, like a law that is not just is not a just law at all? Or something, something along those lines. Yeah, and kind of tailing off on that, Phoenix, there was a group of some kind of coalition, I believe, that you spoke about earlier, trying to kind of maybe organize together in community in response to this. Because I know when you think about a lot of the national issues that we look at as people of color and specifically as LGBTQ people, you don't really see enough like interminglings within local orgs. And I mean, you can say that for the queer community here pretty clearly. Mm-hmm. But what were you bringing up for this kind of resistance?
So recently a coalition of groups have been talking about running Rip City, so to speak. And it's a bunch of different organizations, both you could say more like radically left, as well as like some more liberal organizations are coming together to do this thing to pretty much build dual power. And when I say dual power, I'm referring to the idea of creating alternative institutions to help support and sustain our work so that we aren't becoming burnt out. So to go back to MLK, the Montgomery bus boycotts were not just a boycott of the buses. It also included the community coming together and creating their own alternative means of transportation so that people could still get to work. People would offer up their cars and drive people to other people who had the time to drive their cars to get people to work. And this network of transportation the community built, we can think of that in terms of dual power. This means creating alternatives to the state and the resources and services the state creates. The Black Panther Party's Food to the People program is another example of this. Their education programs, another example of this. So thinking about that, these group of organizations met recently. I wasn't able to go, but I've known some people who have gone and said that it was pretty good. They're thinking about how we can do that here in Portland, because easily our work could become burnt out. We could have organizers coming in, do all this energy, not having any kind of support, and faltering and falling apart. So thinking about how we can sustain long-term activist strategies is really what this is all about, and something that we should be thinking about.
Which is right. And I mean, for me, I'm just curious to know kind of who's leading those groups, right? And the backgrounds that we've all can bring to the table. And that's kind of clear here in Portland. There's a few other local community members that I've been seeing organize in like smaller kind of group sessions where people are doing open healing community spaces. People are offering food and shelter for folks. And, you know, I'm kind of excited to see if another movement similar to the Black Panther movement unfolds here in Portland. I think that this would be an interesting catalyst for that. And I think there's definitely a lot of possibility, but I definitely think that the coalition building portion is the biggest hurdle because a lot of our groups here within Portland have been so segmented. There's a few groups that have been trying to pave the way for new advocacy efforts. I know the Bus Project and like Q Center have been working together to kind of try to form, vocalize, and focus on priority populations within the LGBTQ community. There's also Gosh, there was another community group that's just escaped me, but there's a lot of like local groups that are trying to get together that I know for the QTPOC, but I would love to see that kind of expand into a national movement.
Definitely.
It's just chill. And then on that note, I believe we're going to kind of segue into that next break.
Leave your face at the door. Turn off your swag and check your bag. From your limbs to your Timbs, get down. But whatever you do, hey, don't funk with my groove. Whatever you do, don't funk with my groove. Whatever you do, don't funk with my groove. Whatever you do.
QTPOC Talk here with Darian Jones.
And Phoenix Singer.
And Angelita Murillo.
And now we're kind of going to shift the conversation to kind of, you know, talk about the people who could be viewed as oppressors in our community and essentially the ones who can kind of carry the gambit and maybe change the system that we've kind of been indoctrinated to. And kind of part of that was really taking a look at the way our law enforcement has kind of responded here in Portland, and essentially the way it's responded around the nation, and sort of what we as a community are seeking in hopes of change from them. And so Angelina, I know you had some thoughts that you wanted to kind of offer here as some tidbits of advice for those few who will be willing to kind of take it.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I'm about to say is probably not very palatable, as much of what I say is not. But I think, I guess the perfect little story that I have for this is the night that I was at one of the protests at downtown, I think it was November 11th or 12th, it got pretty violent there. There was tear gas, flash bombs, all that.
Yeah.
And I was standing directly in front of the police. They were, I could touch them if I reached my arm out.
Mm.
And I started crying. I wasn't really afraid, but I was just really emotionally overwhelmed. And it was just really disheartening to see, I think. And some of the riot police, they were all like 6 feet tall. I'm like 5 foot two for reference. They were like 6 foot four. And they were holding giant batons. And when I started crying, one of them looked at me and we just stared at each other for a very long time. It was like 10 to 15 seconds, just looking at each other in silence. And he pulled his mask down and he mouthed the word to me, "I'm sorry," from that distance. And then he put his mask back up. And I just remember looking at him and I said, "Your sorry doesn't mean anything to me because I can't do anything with your words." And so I guess for police officers, even if you consider yourself good people or are doing community work or whatever, what we need you to do is to step down and to join us. Ultimately, that is what we need you to do, to actually take a hard stance against oppression and against the fact that you are being employed by the state to protect the state and the government, not to protect the people. When we were at that protest, people were chanting, "Take off your riot gear. I don't see no riot here." And it's true. We were just standing there. We weren't doing anything bad. And the riot police already showed up before anything had happened. And I think that just says a lot about the fact that officers are made to protect the state and not actually to protect the people.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you serve and who do you want to protect?
Yeah, I can recall a few videos that I'd seen because I couldn't attend that one. And it was very frightening and scary. I watched tear gas, you know, fill the streets, and I saw the smoke bombs get thrown at people and actually land on one of my colleagues. And it was, it's I'm at a kind of like a near loss of words here for it. Phoenix, what are your kind of thoughts and the response that you're hoping to kind of see from our city and the people that we kind of put in power to protect us and keep us safe when, you know, we need it most and they're not actually, you know, following suit with that?
Yeah. So I'm going to name drop a pretty cool essay called Against Innocence by Jackie Wong. You can find it for free on the internet. I bring up this essay primarily because she talks about how the discourses around police violence, I think this is very relevant to riots. Often the only people that are even allowed to mourn and to organize around are people that we think are perfect. And we'll often focus on a child that is killed by a police officer, but then not really talk about the police brutality and the police murders that happen all the day to people who don't have perfect records. Maybe people that are domestic abusers and then get caught by a cop like on the street and get killed. Or someone who has repeated drug felony offenses and have been to prison. Those usually are not the people we organize around. But I think a huge thing to remember is that even if we don't defend those people, we haven't actually met the problem and addressed it head on. And even if a lot of those protesters were violent, which they weren't, meaning that it doesn't matter if you're violent or not, it would not justify that kind of response from the Portland police. Ultimately, any kind of reaction of force that they have is illegitimate. It doesn't matter if the people involved were or were not perfect.
Mm. Yeah, and I think there's a lot of hypocrisy, too, on the side of Democrats, where people talk about wanting to reduce violence and getting rid of guns and weapons and all that. But we never talk about disarming the police, really, and making sure that they also don't have weapons.
Right.
It should be a state where we don't have police that are able to enforce laws upon us like that.
How can they protect us without weapons? That's like a legitimate question people will pose, and I'm curious.
Yeah.
I think that the fact that you think that you will be protected by police is a matter of privilege, right? Because like if you're a person of color who appears like a person of color, then the police often don't protect you and don't serve you. And I think that that's important to keep in mind. If you can walk by police officers and feel protected and safe, then that probably means that you're white or white passing the way that I am.
And that kind of segues into this other question that I've been pondering about how can we hold them accountable and like how can we get them to engage? And I'm really, really wanting to know the answer because to me, it doesn't seem like, you know.
Well, I think what's great about that is I just read this article like last week from the Portland Mercury they were doing a bunch of studies on officers and how the public outrage has actually changed the amount of force that officers use, not because they have a moral, not because they are morally appalled by it, but because they fear the backlash from citizens. And so I think the fact that citizens are being so outraged and so vocal about it will reduce the amount of force that they use. And I think that that's inherently valuable.
Yeah. Cop watches, I think, are a really good way to address
this. Start a cop watch.
Yeah. Just film any kind of police interaction that you see. Even if we just like look at like a show like Cops, which is really a pro-police propaganda on like primetime television, we see who the police target, which is primarily poor black and brown people, also poor white people too, to a lesser degree. And I think it's really important to have all of this on camera, to have all of this filmed so that we know who's doing what and why, and to really even prevent and de-escalate things.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point as in kind of how people can, you know, actually hold law enforcement around them accountable, because, you know, as a person of color, I don't feel like I'm empowered to do that. You know, like I might get in trouble for trying to talk to a cop about another cop because, you know, Blue Lives Matter. And it's just I think I'm at a real shifting point now in kind of like the way that I'm trying to sort of engage with the system as I've heard from a few other people out there. And, you know, I'm kind of also wondering, maybe Angelita, what you think some of the challenges and the pitfalls have been kind of in the movement that's been started so far here in Portland. Cause I mean, you can kind of see that there's definitely a lot of pushback from our city. It just seems that like every corner, kind of visually, like in the march, I don't know if you saw, but like every time that would go somewhere, the cops would be like, no, you can't go this way.
Yeah.
No, you gotta stop. You gotta stop. We keep shifting it. We keep shifting what we want you to do so that this, you can't change anything. So I'm curious to know what you think the pitfalls and challenges are and how to overcome those.
Well,
just a big question.
Yeah, okay. No, that's perfect. Just from what I observed at protests, it was this kind of, there was a divide between the protesters, right? Because there were the people that were like, okay, we need to actually cause a disruption so that people will pay attention to us, which I think is the most effective form of protest. And then there were the people that were trying to be nice with the cops, I guess, and were like, we should just comply and move streets when they tell us to. And I was like, that's not a protest. If you are not inconveniencing power, then how is that a protest? Not to mention that if the police are telling you to move to a certain street, that undoubtedly means that they're kettling you and that they're going to start arresting people and that they're surrounding you. So pro tip, don't do what cops tell you to do at protests, because that will most likely get you in trouble.
Yep.
I think there's a divide between groups where people don't understand, because there's still this idea of like, oh, there are good cops and they're great. And I'm sure that there are cops that are good people. I'm not saying that that's not true, but they either understand their place in power and don't care to relinquish it, or they actually don't understand their place in power and what they are actually doing, which is protecting the state and not people. And I don't know. Does that answer your question?
It does. And I can kind of hear some energy over here, because just to let all of our listeners know, Olivia has just joined us in the building. Do you want to say hello, Olivia?
Yeah. Hi, guys. Sorry. I've started a new job, which means that I barely make it here on time sometimes. But I'm so happy to join this conversation and really excited to have a guest that I've wanted on the show for a while, Angelita.
Hello.
Yeah. And she's been active, as you guys have known, in protests and was pepper sprayed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she
it's
gives
not
a,
fun.
Yeah, and she gives a really great alternative voice to some of the other things we've heard on the show, like last episode. And I love hearing from her.
How do you think law enforcement can kind of better become more receptive to the needs of the community right now?
Well, I think that Phoenix might agree with me that I don't think that there's a way to reform the system. I think mm-hmm. we need to abolish it and start with something completely different. There are people who are definitely reformists. I think that probably Greg or the other groups that you were talking to, they're more into like the idea of police reform.
Definitely.
Yeah, and Phoenix can talk more about some of the alternatives when people talk. When people say abolish the police, I know it sounds scary, but it has a specific meaning, and I would ask Phoenix to go into that.
Yeah, Phoenix,
that.
What do you
yeah.
mean by abolish the...
Well, first I want to say primarily about why a lot of people oppose police reforms. So we've been reforming the police as an institution for over 100 years, and they just get stronger and more sophisticated at their jobs. Body cameras, which a lot of people saw like a big push towards police accountability, mm-hmm. have actually been used in the favor of police in many like recent lawsuits. They can just turn them off and then commit crimes, and then there's no real evidence. And then you don't really get in trouble for that. So clearly not a solution. By abolishing the police, we mean to stop the racial form of policing where poor people, black and immigrants, are continuously watched and policed. We mean, of course, to create more community forms of justice. There's mm-hmm. been all sorts of studies about how for a lot of crimes, like for instance stealing, when there's a process in which both parties can talk about why they did this and how, why they felt hurt, what drove them to do this, why you feel bad about it, that they actually are able to come to a mutual decision about how to best address the harm the other has done. And I think that's really a solution we should be moving forward, since a lot of the crimes people are arrested for are nonviolent, and even when violent mm-hmm. are for survival or one-off things that... And I'm forgetting who said it, but you can't disappear social problems.
Oh, that was, I believe that was Angela Davis.
Okay.
Who was talking about
prisons.
Prisons and prison abolition. Angela Davis is, as Angie can attest to as well, we're both big fans of Angela Davis. And she is a prison abolitionist, not a prison reformist, a prison abolitionist. And that is because, you know, you probably know this, and I don't know if our audience does, but the beginnings of the police and the beginnings of prison in the United States all have to do with the sort of reproduction and extension of slavery and putting mm-hmm. different names to different things. And so I don't think, yeah, they're just black codes. So I don't think an institution that has no reference for its own history, how many police officers know that there's not a huge difference between how they started and slavery?
I don't know.
I don't know.
We should,
you know what I mean?
Leave that question for our listeners to ponder.
I know.
As we enter into our next break here.
Away, 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 To run it away, thought in my head be feeling clearer. I travel 70 states, thought moving around make me feel better. I tried to let go my lover, thought if I was alone then maybe I could recover. To write it away, I'll cry it away.
Don't you cry, babe.
I love that album.
Yeah, we all love Beyonce too. Solange?
Oh my god, you're so shady.
I'm not that shady.
So shady. That was Solange.
I'm just a Virgo, true and true.
Thank you.
Thank you all, and welcome back to Cutie Pock Talk. I'm Darian Jones here with Phoenix Singer. Oh.
Yeah, Phoenix.
Olivia.
And our guest.
Oh. Oh, I'm sorry. I ruined that whole thing.
It's okay. It's okay. You can make it yourself. It's improv a little bit. So we're kind of going to type her back into where we left off with looking towards solutions for kind of the current state that we've entered into as a nation, and really as a country and world. So there were some thoughts that were brought up over the break from Olivia and Angelita in kind of response to year-long solutions and the history of what kind of peaceful protests look and how they started and the real intentions for those communities and what we want to see as communities that end up protesting, because those are largely communities of color. So I don't know which one of you all want to kind of interject.
Well, Olivia wrote this incredible article. I recommend everyone read it. I can't do that. Just kidding. Incredible article about nonviolent protests and how, I'll let her talk about it more, about how it always comes back to bodies being brutalized by the state. And I think that I would just tie that back to what I saw a lot during the protests, which is that there was a big divide between the protesters, between people who wanted to act quote unquote nonviolently, and then people who were actually thinking about what that means critically. And there was a lot of talk of nonviolence when people started breaking windows, like the Chase Bank windows, stuff like that. And people were calling that violence. And I think we need to make a distinguishing point and understand that breaking windows is not violence upon a body. It's violence against property, and property isn't sentient, so it's not even violence. And there were kind of petty disagreements which tore the protesters apart, because there were people that were defending the Chase Bank windows, which personally, I don't care that much about Chase Bank windows because they funded the Dakota Access Pipeline. I don't have that much sentiment towards them. Exactly, in prisons. And so we were having kind of this petty feud amongst ourselves about what nonviolent protest means. And Olivia can expand more on what it actually means and the history behind that. But I think that it's really important right now that we be united and that we forget these petty differences in order to actually do what's necessary to protect the people who are most vulnerable.
Yeah, and piggybacking off of what Angelita said, thank you so much for, liking my article. but I'm concerned about a deep misunderstanding on the left about what nonviolent protest means and its history. And I noticed that the right has something that we don't. They have an institution and they have a memory. So the CIA has existed for a very long time. The police force has existed for a very long time. But it's hard to say on the left that we have something that's collecting information or data on our oppressors or violence against us for that amount of time. And so I just quickly wanted to say that we need that kind of institutional memory keeping on the left, one, and two, that if somebody was going to take that upon themselves to say, I want a nonviolent protest, a nonviolent protest was originally a form of exposing the violence of white supremacy of the state. Hmm. So white people and black people would do things like go to a lunch counter that was white only, and they would sit, and that's nonviolent. The act is not hurting anyone, right? But the people who were counter-revolutionary or counter-protesters would physically attack them, and that included the police, and their job as quote-unquote nonviolent protesters was to let them. So it wasn't just we march and then we get out of the way because the cop told us to get out of the street. It was you knew when you performed a quote-unquote nonviolent act that you were going to incite the other party to show their true colors or whatever those were. And those stock photos that we have now of all that violence against the people peacefully sitting in India, against people peacefully sitting at lunch counters, against people peacefully marching on Bloody Sunday, all of those really memorable quote-unquote nonviolent images are actually of violence on behalf of the state, of police, of white supremacists, of the right. So that even when we are quiet, we expose them. It doesn't work if you're not really, you know what I mean, inciting something.
What you also explained in that is that you're still causing a disruption. You're still being inconvenient to people, even though you're not fighting back. Like them sitting at the lunch counters and preventing other people from going in and getting business, that's a way of inconveniencing them, right? And I think that that kind of parallels with the protest where we were just standing in the street not doing anything except blocking traffic, and that is an inconvenience in order to garner attention. But then you had leftists that were acting as if though that was an act of violence, that inconveniencing people is violent. And that's not violence. That's necessary. That's what protest is.
If you cannot impede power, you cannot change it. So people were shouting, get a job. People are shouting, go home. People were shouting racial slurs. People were trying to get that other group by Craig to fundraise money to fix private property and telling sob stories about individuals and moms and people who got their cars tarnished or something in a fight. But I think that the bigger picture is that we don't hear that same kind of sadness or conversation or call for fundraising when it comes to black lives. So the police kills how many black men, how many black women every year? And then do you hear groups of white folks saying, can we fundraise to fix this? It wasn't really fair that you guys came and broke it. So it kind of disgusts me when we care more about private property, unsentient private property today, than we do about black lives.
Right, which I mean, I think a big portion of the peaceful protests, I guess, given the context and the history that you just provided our listeners, is to kind of, you know, bring to light the atrocities that we're experiencing every day. And, you know, as someone who has, you know, access to Facebook in the 21st century and can stream things, I've been able to kind of view these atrocities in real time, you know, more than just like a video, more than like real life, more than re-seeing it, nothing more than real life. But like, I was there, like virtually, as these bombs were going off, as people I knew were screaming and running. And, you know, when I think about the creations, as you just described, of a peaceful protest, is to uncover what's already there so that people can actually see the realities that we live in. I definitely think that, you know, we're kind of getting to the point where it's becoming more visible because, you know, earlier Angelita brought up the fact that people... it's here, it's apparent, and it's you have to be aware in that because it's now uncovered. I just lost the thought.
Because it's been uncovered, we have to look at it.
Well, we have to look at it, but there's a different way that people need to engage with it now, and that we need more bodies that are there. We need more people engaging. It was a great thought. Now it's gone.
Well, you know what? It's not just people, though. I'm going to finish off maybe with this thought. if I can, just that we keep on looking at ourselves on the left and saying, you know, hey, we didn't do this, we didn't do that. And I think the beacon of hope that we can take from this is that it's not about self-criticism, because self-criticism is still self-centered. I think it's important to look outside at who the enemy is and what our abusers look like so that we can unite instead of self-criticize constantly as the left. And one of those united ideas we can have looking at the right is to say, these are a united group of white supremacists, and they don't challenge each other on whether or not one of them is using violence or not. They're not couching how they hate us and how they kill us in little tiny ways. They are effective because they know what they're doing. They're watching us. They have structures in place to remember what they did and how we revolted last time and how to incorporate that into their next oppressive technique. Neoliberalism is constantly reincorporating our activism into letting it sort of make soft capitalism or capitalism with a nice face or white supremacy with a nice face. So stop. The infighting doesn't need to be about what techniques or whether we have a state or not once the revolution comes or something, or whether or not we're going to fundraise for so-and-so. It needs to be, what are we going to do to end white supremacy today?
I love that, Olivia. That is kind of the perfect note to end this episode on, because, you know, it's, you know, we asked earlier, how can we get our white allies to engage and to show up? How can we get law enforcement to not just take down their masks because they're about to beat people with a baton, but actually get out of the line? And how can we unite?
You have to make them.
I think people are getting to that point.
Yeah.
I think people are getting to that point. So we'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in tonight to Cutie Pock Talk. Our wonderful guest, Angelita, who had to leave a little early. And with that note, I'm going to let everybody else sign off.
Thank you. This is Olivia signing out. Hopefully I'll be earlier next month. Bye.
Yeah. This is Phoenix saying goodbye.
Enjoy your holidays.
Paparazzi, catch my fly, my coffee fresh. My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas. Make a Texas, make a Texas, make a, make a, make a, make a, make, 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 make. You mix that Negro with that Creole, 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 Creole. You mix that Negro with that.
And you were listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio coming up next.
Give to KBOO today during our end-of-year match. Starting November 1st and wrapping up December 31st, donations from all new and increasing members will be matched one-to-one up to $15,000 from the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Give an extra gift today or become a member